When we discuss the topics of pisule, kahal, people who may not marry into the Jewish community, we often focus on the communities of the Falashim in Ethiopia, the Bnei Yisrael in Bnei Menashe and Cochin in India. We discuss the Russians, the Sephardic Anusim, people who left Spain. Discuss other communities, the Shomronim, the Karaites, and those who study these topics, you know, probably hear plenty about that. There are plenty of books and articles written on each of those topics, and Pesachim that are being written even till today. I thought it would be worthwhile to focus on a often not discussed case study of a kehillah that was at one point called into question. Not to highlight its significance, but rather to highlight its Baruch Hashem insignificance. As the end of the day, the halacha is that they are all mutarim lavo b'kahal. But that said, it is certainly worthwhile to highlight this point in halachic history where this question was raised, in order to address it properly. Albeit there isn't that much to say, to make sure that the case is clear, and the conclusion is clear, which it was not, as you will see immediately. And therefore, Be'ezat Hashem, to continue appreciating the privilege of being Mutarim Lavo B'Kahal. The 1700s in Iran, the Iran has historically primarily been a Shiite country, you know, Shiite as opposed to Sunni, and not for now, but the two different denominations of Islam. Whether you go with the Sunnis and the Caliphate, or if you go with the Shiites and the Imams, depending on which general leadership post Muhammad is your flavor. One major difference between the two is that Shiites are much more concerned for Tum'ah than the Sunnis are. So they're more concerned about the Tum'ah imparted by different things and staying very far away from it in general, even though there is no Beis HaMikdash. That said, a major progenitor of Tum'ah is none other than Jewish people. You know, the Ruach and other such things that come from them, Negiah and the like, are all purveyors of Tum'ah. That's called Najes. I have an uncle who, you know, does not wear a kippah too often, and he was on a plane one time, and he was sitting next to somebody who was speaking Farsi also, and they were getting to know each other and talking and, you know, like, you know, hugging and, you know, maybe shaking hands. And then by the end of the plane ride, his neighbor realizes that my uncle is not Jewish. Hey, my uncle is Jewish, and he realizes, uh-oh, you're not Jess. And he moves away from him to stay as far away as he can from the dirty Jew. So 90% of Muslims worldwide are Sunni, 10% are Shiite. Guess where the biggest concentration of Shiites is? None other than Iran. For that reason, among other reasons, perhaps, and a discussion for another time, there was an unfortunate lack of Torah study proliferation in the area we know today as Iran. For simply put, the tremendous, tremendous persecution of Jews throughout history. Whereas in other countries, in Sunni countries, Jews were able to live more alongside the Muslims. In Shiite countries, they were constantly persecuted and not really allowed to, you know, proliferate, especially in their religious observance. That doesn't mean they were not religious, as we'll discuss in a different context, but and in this one, but it means that there was much less Torah, much less Chokhmah, much less certainly yeshivot, when people are putting guns or swords to your head and saying, convert or die, convert or leave. It doesn't really work so well. Whereas in Morocco, Iraq, Syria, Algeria, Mitzrayim, and other places, it was fairly easy to coexist. True, the Pact of Umar, you know, legislated that Jews are second-class citizens, known as dhimma, and all the halachot that came from that Jews can't come out at certain times of day, they can't come out when it's raining because their tumah will be imparted, and all sorts of other wonderful things about how their homes have to be lower than everybody else's homes, and they can't own slaves, but Muslim can't own slaves, and whatever. The historians know that that was mostly on paper and in the books, and fairly seldom enforced to its fullest extent. The exception to that, guess what, isn't none other than Iran, where the Jews were certainly kept in their dhimma status in many senses of the term. And there was one slight respite from this difficulty. And just a full disclosure, I love history, but I am by no means an expert. If I make a mistake, by all means, correct me. A lot of my information comes from various online resources, but certainly it has to be mentioned that Rafael Patai's book Jadid al-Islam is certainly an important source that really, really does a good job of collecting and presenting much of the information. There is a whole shelf of books on Mashhad in the YU library. To my distress, I'm not able to devote all the time I would like to reading through every single one of them. Ezrat Hashem Yavo Hayom, Hazman V'Hamakom. But in the meantime, read Patai's book, and then Ben Sion Yehoshua Raz, who's a professor in Eretz Yisrael, has lots of good articles. He's a scholar of Afghani Jewry, but Mashhad, as we will see, is none other than the northeastern tip of the country, in fairly close proximity to Afghanistan and Turkmenistan. So it was very important. Now, Iran had a brief respite when Nader Shah took over, and he was very pro the Jews. He was a Sunni, not a Shiite, and things got along a little bit better by him. I don't know enough of the details to speak confidently about them, but at least for our situation, Nader Shah decided, through some perhaps apocryphal story of witnessing the yashrut of Jews who were arguing about money, not about who can keep the money, but who should take the money. And this one was saying, you take, the other one was saying, that one take it. And it was some Dine Mamonot question, and he heard about it, and he was so impressed. He decided that he needs these people to be in charge of his jewelry or other treasures, whatever they may be. And he commissioned that 40 families from different cities in the Ghazvin province to go to the Khorasan province to guard his jewels. They went from Delman, Diel, Kashan, Sabzivar, Khordevan, among other places. And eventually, and he died before this really took off, they all settled in Mashhad's Jewish ghetto. As we'll see, these became the Jews of Mashhad, even though it's a little bit funny. How are you Mashhadi and your last name is Kashizadeh, your last name is Dilmani, or Sabzivari, or Khordevani? Aren't those other cities? The answer is, yeah, they are from those other cities, but then they became Mashhadi. They were the Jews of Mashhad. So the Jews in Mashhad came in 1746. They lived there for whatever amount of time. Fast forward to 1839, and there is a blood libel. Whether it be for one apocryphal story or the other, there are different conflicting accounts, some of better authenticity than others. Doesn't really make a difference for our purposes. The maskana was convert or die, and guess what? Everybody converted. So, Baruch Hashem, this is well documented. My point here is not to tell you the history, but to give you the background you need to learn the halakha. So, there are five times in the 80 years following this blood libel in 1839, there were many attempts to escape, to go to other places, and unfortunately there were many cases when they were brought back. Some managed to make it out and move on to other places like Eretz Yisrael, but by and large, the Jews of Mashhad remained in Mashhad. They lived on the outside as Muslims, as they had been converted to Islam. They said the line, Allahu Akbar, Ma'alav et Nasrullah, whatever it is. and then they lived as crypto Jews. They were Moser Nefesh, in every sense of the word, to live as Jews. They, on the outside, they had the classic Muslim theophoric names, Abdul Rahim, Abdullah, Lotfullah. They made the Hajj. They went to Mecca, and they also went to Eretz Yisrael, and the other Hajj, the real Hajj. But they kept underground schools, shuls, shachita, weddings, tahara. They were mostly nefesh to have their own things, with tremendous insularity to protect the integrity of their community. They made sure to marry their daughters off very young, extremely young, under the age of 10, so that when Muhammad, the neighbor, came and asked for a daughter, he'd say she's taken already. They had the ketubah, and the Muslim ketubah, and the Jewish ketubah. One was public, one was private. They had their own minyanim. They had so much going on for them. They kept the Torah as much as they could, and had weddings, and everything was beautiful. A tremendous mesirut nefesh. This bred a sense of insularity, of community cohesiveness, which continues in many ways until today, and rightfully so. That it was created to keep the Torah, to keep the Judaism alive. A brief aside: converting to Islam, you know, the permissibility of doing such under some circumstances. Right, the Torah says that v'chai v'hem, a person has to keep to live rather than violate a mitzvah in the Torah. So if you're given the option to eat pork or die, one has to certainly eat the pork, except if it is in a shemad, sha'at ha-shemad, in which it is to cause one to, you know, just intentionally violate his religion. The exception to the general rule is the big three, that are, instead of being avor v'al yehareg, rather it is you should die than to allow yourself to be killed rather than to violate the Avera, the big three cardinal sins of Resicha, Gidla Rayot, and Avodah Zarah, is idolatry, murder, and forbidden relations. So as unfortunately has been the case, halakha l'maaseh, when the sword has been put to the heads of the Jews and said, told, and they've been told to convert to Christianity, no, unfortunately, we have had way too many people have to practice the halacha of allowing their lives to be taken. The question is, what about Islam? You know, is Islam avodah zarah? Is it idolatry or not? At the end of the day, they believe in the same Hashem. They just have a Navi Hashaker. They have a false prophet. Is that considered avodah zarah, that one should have to give up his life, you know, as a cardinal sin to avoid violating? Or is it perhaps different? If someone puts a gun to your head and says, become a Democrat or become a Republican or Libertarian, you might think it's the worst thing in the world. But that doesn't mean that it's a different religion. It's a set of values that aren't, that for the moment, let's just say, don't contradict the Torah. They don't deny the existence of God and all of the mitzvot. So what's the big deal? If you identify in a way that perhaps, you know, all but idolizes a living being or a dead being as being the, oh, George Washington, the leader of the United States of America, we love him, he's the best. That doesn't mean avodah zarah. So is Islam really the same or not? So this is a big discussion. The Rambam, who calls Muhammad a meshuga, says in Mishneh Torah that Islam is not avodah zarah, but there are contradictions in the Perusha Mishnah that seem to say that it is. Those contradictions have been resolved. Nowadays, we don't look at those contradictions. The Chida already resolved them. There are mistakes in the Perush and Mishnah. The Ikar is that the Rambam says that Islam is not Avodah Zarah. We have a halachic tradition as such, from the days of the Rambam in Mitzrayim, through the Radbaz in Mitzrayim, and the Nahar Mitzrayim, where they put into practice halachot that depended upon this basis, in terms of their wine, and the handling of their wine, transport of their wine, that claimed, and basically the foundation was that Islam is not avodah zarah, and therefore, whatever happens to the wine, not for now, will depend on that. That said, pashut pshat is that the Rambam thinks that it is not avodah zarah, so it should follow that it is not yehareg val yavor to convert to Islam. The Radbaz, Rabbeinu David ben Zimra, and the Ritva disagree with the Rambam. They say that anything that's not Judaism is avodah zarah. And classically, that is how this machloket is pitched. The Rambam says it's okay, and the Radbaz says it's not. In fact, the Rambam has a Igeret Hashmad, where he wrote to Teiman that b'diavad, if they converted to Islam, it's okay. So that would seem to fit with what we said already. Now, Rav Schechter has told me that is incorrect, because conversion to Islam is Yehareg Val Yavor, as Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik wrote a thesis where he argued, called Maimonides Igeret Hashmad, Law and Rhetoric, where he argues that the Rambam was just trying to make people in the Teiman feel good, b'diavad, but be'emet, it would be Yehareg V'alit Aslem, and there is no machloket here. And true, Allahu Akbar, Muhammad Rasulullah, literally translates Hashem's great Muhammad is Shaliach. The idea is that Muhammad came and said, Dinei HaTorah no longer apply. That's called being modiv avodah zarah, to say the Torah no longer applies. Admitting the Torah doesn't apply is certainly Yehareg V'al Ya'avor. That said, even though it is Yehareg V'al Yit Aslem, Islam is not avodah zarah. It's a monotheistic religion, and that has its own ramifications. There are those who have said that the Rambam was trying to not say things explicitly. He was afraid of calling it out. That's ridiculous. The Rambam calls Muhammad a Mishuga, as Muhammad himself was called in his lifetime by the Jews of Medina before he killed them. So I don't think that's a fair argument. You want to tell me that the Klosenberger Rebbe said otherwise? Okay, the Klosenberger Rebbe and the Tzitz Eliezer didn't read Yabi Omer. They should. It's very clear. The Chida quoted by the Rav Avadia. I saw the Chida myself. Didn't Rav Avadia tell it to me? Make it very clear that the Rambam thinks it's not avodah zarah. Okay, moving on. Now back to our story. What you think I have to wait for an opportunity to say this shiur on its own? I'm here talking about Mashad. This is the best time to talk about it. So it's a tangent from Avin Ha'ezer to go to Yoredeya. Okay, so we'll talk about Yoredeya for a second. Now, back to our show. In terms of Mashad, Professor Patai, in his epilogue, makes a very good point that there's a big difference between Mashad in Spain. In Spain, there was an office of the Inquisition that made sure that your conversion was upheld, that you abided by it. But in Mashhad, there was no such thing. Every group lived in its own separate part of town. They had their own schools, their own mosque, their own burial, and everything. So it was actually, not to say easy, but it was doable for the Mashhadi Jews to do what they did, to live underground and maintain for almost 100 years, to maintain for 80 years, whatever it is, their state, their status, and their traditions. You know, they were able to do everything underground because nobody was checking to see what they were doing in their homes. It was totally inappropriate for someone to walk into another person's home uninvited. And the Muslims were not about to break their etiquette just for checking on the Jews whom they don't really care about and used to be Najas anyways. So in 1925, after all these years, Reza Shah takes power, the Pahlavi dynasty, and he permits freedom of religious practice in Iran. Mashadis begin to practice their Jewish faith openly, and everything seems okay until 20 years later in 1946, the disenchanted community, the community was disenchanted by a blood libel, which led to its gradual relocation to the tolerant cities of Tehran, Yerushalayim, and they joined the few Mashadi families who had already settled there. Meanwhile, they have also been, over the past century, Mashadis who made it to other places, such as Eretz Yisrael, namely Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim, as well as New York and London. So, at this time, in the late 40s, after this blood libel takes place, the Mashadis around the world begin lobbying for the aid of their brethren, mostly unsuccessfully, until in 1949, the Mashadis in Brooklyn, believe it or not, in Brooklyn, petitioned President Chaim Weizmann of Eretz Yisrael to please save the brethren. There's major poverty, there's intermarriage and conversion to Islam and Baha'i. Please, please, please save our brethren. So Weizmann forwards the request to the Sochnut. Yitzchak Rafael, who's the president of the Sochnut, at least the immigration part of the Sochnut, asks Rav Herzog, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, to look into this. What, these people were Muslim for like almost a century. Can we bring them to Eretz Yisrael? What is this? So if Herzog asks Rabbi Yitzchak Levi, who was the person who started the Otzar Torah schools in Iran, and is so responsible for the Talmud Torah of so many in Tehran, Mashhad, Shiraz. And Rav Herzog's Maskana is, oddly enough, not printed in Rav Herzog's collected writings. Some say that Rav Herzog was he was a super genius, no question. Some say that Rav Herzog was too busy to edit his own stuff, and as such, things slipped through. And even though Rav Shlomo Shapira was a Dayan Beit Din HaGadol Rabbani, put everything together in this beautiful set that we have, the Kitvei HaRav Herzog, somehow this one didn't get in. It's been published around, it's not a secret, but it's not immediately available for those who don't know where to look. So, and this is now late 1949, early 1950, and Rav Herzog asks, he says, listen, if anyone can do teshuvah, that's not a big deal. Everyone, and you want to come, you're an Anus, you're a crypto Jew, you want to come out, that's great, please, we'll accept you with open arms. But we have to figure out, was there any intermarriage? You might need to have some conversions just to make sure that people are Jewish. And even if there weren't any intermarriage, who says that there aren't mamzerim out there? Listen, they might have had kiddushin, kisherim. You might decide that their kiddushin was good, that they were kisherim le'edut. But what about gerushin? There are no gitin. So they got divorced by the Qadi, but they didn't have a get, kedam Moshe v'Yisrael. And the woman's going to get remarried and bar minan, you'll have mamzerim. That's not good. So, yeah, it's possible it didn't happen at all, but it's something we have to look into. We have halachot and Ibn Ezer. What to do when someone comes and says he's a Jew? When are we concerned for mamzerut? When are we not? So Rav Herzog wanted the research to be done. And he basically wanted, at the end of the day, Gerut l'chumra. At this point, I think it seems that he forwarded the question also to Rav Ben Zion Meir Chai Uziel, who was the co-chief rabbi at the time. This is 1950, 3 years or so before Rav Uziel dies. To this, Rav Uziel responded. Rav Uziel was a Sfaradi. He lived more amongst the Sfaradim in Yerushalayim. Perhaps that lent itself to his understanding of the Kehillah. He did actually have a Teshuvah to the Mashadis in Yerushalayim, published about 20 years earlier. They certainly were not foreign to him. And Rav Uziel apparently responded that these people gave their lives to keep their Torah mitzvos. They did everything they could, and they certainly kept their family's integrity intact. Certainly, if they ever needed a get, they would go get a get. Don't worry about it, it's fine. This Teshuvah Rav Uziel is not published. Or rather, is published, in quotation. The Sochnut in its 1950 journal, its annual journal that reviews its activities for the year in Dapei Aliyah of 1950, just quote, copies and pastes these two letters from the chief rabbis, which were altogether, it seems, enough to allow this endeavor, this campaign to proceed. To our misfortune, we have not located the actual letter of Rav Uziel. I spent way too many hours looking for it, as all of these letters until Rav Uziel's letter, the 46 Mashadi community that reached out, I think from London, 49 from Brooklyn, Weitzman's letter to the Sochnut, the Sochnut's letter to Rav Herzog, Rav Herzog's letter back to the Sochnut, those are all published in a file in the archives of the State of Israel, Archeon HaMedina, and a link I'll make available in the source sheets. The problem is that it stops there. If you only read that, you would think that there's something wrong in the Maaseh and that it shouldn't be okay for them to be here. Only when you read the Professor Ben Sion Yehoshua Raz's article or Patai's book or other articles, you actually see that Rav Uziel responded, and the source comes from Dapei Aliyah, which you wouldn't have looked into either, because why would you look at something from 1950? If you don't know where to look. So I spent too many hours looking through the archives of the Medina with no success. Baruch Hashem, the Medina kept everything, even hundreds of pages of thank you letters that Chief Rabbi sent to people thanking them for Sfarim that they got for free, For some reason, this was not kept. It was lost somewhere along the way. Rav Uziel's letter back to the Sochnut, permitting them, and all we have is one line, saying that if they ever needed to get, these people who gave everything for Torah Mitzvot probably would have gotten one. Don't worry about it, it's fine. And that seems to have been enough. I was in touch with Rav Ben Sion Mirchai Uziel's Talmid, Rav Ezra Barnea, who is in charge of the foundation of the heritage of Rav Uziel and publishing of his writings and the like. And Rav Barnea said, although my mother is Mashadi, and I knew that he was lenient on this matter, I did not know there was even a discussion between him and Rav Herzog. This is news to me. And I'm too old to go looking. It's Baruch Hashem in his late 80s. I'm too old to go looking. You should go look in the Zionist archives. So I looked in the Zionist archives, which are the Sochnut archives. And the lady who works there responded to my email, actually did me such a favor and looked through the entire physical file that I was looking through, I asked about, which was basically identical to the one that they had in the archives of the Rabban of the Medina, except that it had two more things in it, which were letters by Rav Uziel. Except one was about Iraq. Something was going on in Iraq at the time. It was terrible, and terrible, terrible, terrible situation for the Jews in Iraq. And then also a letter from Rav Uziel about the Meshadis from later that year, where he discusses, you know, says how, oh yay, they're on their way. Missing the one before it, where he says they should come. And it seems that it's not in the archives at all. That's our loss. Okay, fine. Either way, halakha l'maaseh, Uziel's psak was great, and Professor Ben Sion Yehoshua Raz actually points out how, and Patai makes this point also, that Rav Uziel didn't know all the details. Because Patai writes in a section on marriage, Patai writes how, you know, in Iran it was acceptable to take more than one wife, especially if the first wife was barren. In Mashhad, amongst the Jews, you had to ask permission from the community council, whatever it was. And they had to grant permission, although they didn't have any legislative power, it was social pressure, moral pressure, to listen to the community. There's something to be said about how true that is today also, but that's for another time. Now, Patai says that that was by polygamy. By divorce, was unheard of. It was absolutely, unequivocally prohibited. So much so that when one rabbi came and wanted to institute divorce in Mashhad, he was driven out and not welcomed back. And he was totally kicked out and fired from his position because he wanted to institute divorce. As one Mashhadi told me the other day, his grandmother said, you get married, you don't get divorced. It was that ingrained in them. Certainly more than what Rav Uziel said. So certainly we do not have any chashash mamzerut, we don't have any chashash of intermarriage. And that's why the Mashhadis were allowed to come back, which... And you might claim, you know, argue that there were gittin in Mashhad, but those were, I think, in the 30s, when Rav Chizkiyah HaKohen Rabin was coming from Bukhara on his way to Eretz Yisrael. He stopped in Mashhad and he wrote a bunch of gittin with some famous Mashhadi names on them. Ayin Sham in his book Ateret Chizkiyah, which is available on Hebrew Books and Otzar HaChokhmah. Unfortunately, it's out of print, but okay, fine. So today, Baruch Hashem, Mashadis in Eretz Yisrael, Mashadis in America, in London, and in Milan. 20,000 people or so worldwide. They have shuls in Eretz Yisrael and everywhere else. Beautiful Baruch Hashem. Apparently the shul in Bnei Brak was the subject of much halachic discussion in terms of making a shortcut, because people would always shortcut through it to get to the next place. Rav Avadia used to speak there all the time. Baruch Hashem, it's a community of people who appreciate Torah learning and its chachamim. And Baruch Hashem, with Rav Eliyahu Ben Chaim standing at its helm, there's plenty of Torah, plenty of community Torah guidance in the growth of the community, Baruch Hashem, over all these years. And I have the pleasure, the distinct pleasure of being a part of it, the privilege of being a part of it in the SBM, in the Sephardic Beit Midrash, in Sha'ir HaChamim. Thanks to Baruch Hashem, my dear Mashadi friends from high school, from college, and from the Beit Midrash, that I have the zechut of learning Torah and teaching Torah within the community. As much as I am, Baruch Hashem, a proud Esfahani, it is certainly a privilege to be part of such a holy community in this sense. Such a holy community that Baruch Hashem, you know, maintains its traditions and its integrity from beginning to end. Thank you.